A Venezuelan democracy champion wins a Nobel. Miami-Dade College hands President Trump prime real estate, and Florida removes prideful crosswalks. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll hail today's announcement that Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado has won the Nobel Peace Prize, an award for democracy movements across the Americas. We'll also look at the controversy and now a lawsuit over Miami-Dade College's gift of valuable downtown property for Trump's presidential library. And we'll talk about the response of Florida's LGBTQ community to Florida's campaign to eradicate crosswalk art. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Well, I have no words.
That was the initial reaction of Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado early this morning to the call from Norway telling her that she is this year's winner of the Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Committee lauded Machado for her, quote, tireless work promoting democratic rights for the people of Venezuela and for her struggle to achieve a just and peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy. Machado's Nobel is a much-needed morale boost for Venezuelans a year after their brutal dictatorship stole a presidential election that the opposition won by a landslide, even after the regime barred Machado from running in it. Hundreds of Venezuelans still sit in jail for protesting that fraud, and Machado remains in hiding. Her Nobel win is also a shot in the arm to democracy movements across the hemisphere, from Cuba to Nicaragua. And here in South Florida, it's also a tribute to a Venezuelan diaspora that itself worked tirelessly last year to help galvanize that democratic energy. Are you a Venezuelan, or a Cuban, or any South Floridian celebrating Machado's Nobel Prize? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now are two leaders of that Venezuelan diaspora. Beatriz Olivarria is a coordinator in Miami for Machado's opposition party, Vente Venezuela. Beatriz, always great to have you with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me in this wonderful day today.
And Maria Alejandra Marquez heads the Venezuelan regime watchdog nonprofit INRAV. And always great to have you on as well, Maria Alejandra.
Thank you, team, for the opportunity.
Beatriz Olivarria, I want to play a little bit more of your friend Maria Corina Machado's response this morning to her Nobel Peace Prize, in which she sort of sums up what her work has been about.
Even though we face the most brutal violence, our society has resisted and insisted to struggle through civic means and peaceful means. And I believe that the world will now understand how urgent it is to finally, you know, succeed.
Facing the most brutal violence through civic and peaceful means. Beatriz, as someone who has worked closely with Machado, albeit from exile, how would you describe the pro-democracy opposition movement that she has led for the past two decades against this, as she calls it there, increasingly violent socialist dictatorship in Venezuela?
Well, she is relentless, and she is very well focused. And before the primaries, she went all over. Well, everybody has seen the videos and how, you know, she went in boats and donkeys and horses and motorcycles. She was really relentless, even knowing that the Chavista had people there where she arrived.
And when you say Chavistas, that's the nickname for the dictatorship, to be named after the late dictator Hugo Chavez.
Right, yes. And so, well, they did try to sabotage her. She always had, the things that they were going to get her. And she never stopped. She never stopped. She, and so people started, the Venezuelans, when 2 years ago, were a bit disappointed with other leaders that have come and gone. And Maria Corina really, really just amped up the hope.
Right.
And everybody was as resilient as her.
And Beatrice, how important was it that the democracy movement Machado leads challenged the regime last year in that presidential election rather than boycott the election, as many had argued Venezuela's opposition should do? I mean, even though the regime stole the election and then brutally put down the protests that followed, how important was it to the cause of democracy in Venezuela to go through that election exercise and expose to the world what the real situation there is?
Yeah, I think that was the key. The key is that they had managed to do a program and with a lot of people in every town to have the receipts of the tables and the votes. And there was, I mean, what could they say?
Yeah.
No. They didn't even post the result in the CNA page,
yeah.
Which is, yeah.
No, it was so. But how important was her leadership in the sense that, is it looking back, is it maybe better that she was not a candidate, that she actually played a more valuable role as a democratic symbol through that process rather than as a candidate?
It must have been very hard for her not to be a candidate, but she just was focused on putting someone there that was reliable. And yeah. It was a miracle.
Maria Alejandra Marquez, as I mentioned, you are a leading watchdog in the diaspora here against the corruption of the Venezuelan dictatorship. You've led the creation of legislation, for example, that's in the U.S. Congress now to penalize that corruption more effectively. How important for you has Maria Corina Machado's work been inside Venezuela in terms of keeping the U.S. and the world focused on not just how brutal the dictatorship there is, but how criminal it is?
Well, the amazing work that she did by reuniting a divided country before the elections. And of course, this is a result of more than two decades of work. But what happened a couple of years ago that crystallized in the elections, it's an incredible feat that showed that dictatorships and these terrible regimes can be fought peacefully. And how did she do that? If you had asked me 3 years ago if I believed that Venezuelan opposition would unite behind a candidate and would be able to go through complete a process of elections, I would have laughed because it seemed impossible. She made that possible by inspiring all Venezuelans to participate, by uniting in what is common for all of us. And that type of work, I think she galvanized a movement that has been working for 20 years in the Venezuelan diaspora.
And Maria Alejandra, let me ask you the same question I asked Beatrice earlier. Could the opposition's success in exposing the fraud of the Venezuelan regime last year have happened without Maria Corina Machado's leadership, even after the regime kept her from running in that election? As someone who yourself was deeply involved, like Beatrice, in helping the opposition monitor voting precincts and other and voter tallies, you know, during that election last year, how crucial was Machado's presence in maintaining morale through that struggle?
Oh no, it was not only determinant in achieving that, but she was critical in the organization of that. She has been working on that idea for 20 years. She was leading the movement of participation and counting votes called Súmate 30 years ago.
Right.
So this is something that she has worked and believed in for many, many years. And this is a strategy that was joined by every political party, by more than 200 civil society organizations that work on the ground in Venezuela, who managed to organize around a million volunteers. This is, you said it.
In cells called comanditos, right? That was the famous term, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And the people not only took care of votes, they fed their neighbors that they were counting the votes. They helped mobilize them and brought people with cars so that they could get to places. It was an incredible thing to do when you have such a powerful and violent regime against.
Beatriz Olavarria, someone who has known Maria Corina Machado for many years, Tell us a little about where she draws her courage from, because there's no doubt it's taken a lot of guts for her not only to stand up to the Maduro dictatorship, and I'm referring to current President Nicolas Maduro, to stand up to that dictatorship the way she has, but to stay in Venezuela still now when every day she faces the possibility of arrest. I know, for example, that while the regime likes to call her a right-wing rich woman, she's known also for leading charities for people in some of Caracas's poorest slums, right?
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to start with the... She is relentless. She has she's focused. She never lets anybody, you know, throw the towel, like we say.
Yeah.
It's pretty amazing. She hasn't seen her children many years ago. Her family obviously is very worried, and you know, but now they're used to it because she won't stop. She won't leave Venezuela. She will see this through.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Maria Alejandra Marquez, what has perhaps Maria Corina Machado, though, also learned along the way? I ask that because 20 years ago, she took a lot of criticism inside and outside of Venezuela for leading the boycott of parliamentary elections that many say only served to strengthen Hugo Chavez's dictatorship back then. Mm-hmm. Did she and Venezuela's opposition movement take lessons from episodes like that that have led to the successes that they're experiencing today?
Oh, for sure. I mean, in the sense that we wouldn't be here without all the lessons learned. We have made mistakes. This is a really difficult fight because you're fighting against a government that has all the means, the force of the arms against its citizens, and all the economic power that it had while the price of oil was in its peak a few mm-hmm. years ago, which that mobilized not only powerful movements within the country, but outside the country too. So mm-hmm. Whatever mistakes were made, definitely the whole Venezuelan society, not only their leaders and not only Maria Corina, learned from them. We all mm-hmm. did.
All right.
And that's the only way we could have been united last year for the elections.
No, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Venezuelan diaspora leaders Beatriz Olavarria and Maria Alejandra Marquez about today's announcement that Venezuelan democracy leader Maria Corina Machado has won the Nobel Peace Prize. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Beatriz Olavarria, we obviously have to point out that Maria Corina Machado's Nobel Prize for Peace would seem to contrast, if not contradict, the current rumblings we're hearing from the Trump administration that it might use the U.S. military to strike not just at the drug trafficking the Venezuelan regime is accused of running, but at the Venezuelan regime itself. So given, as she said, the civic and peaceful means Machado's movement has championed to help bring democracy to Venezuela, do you think she herself would agree with the idea of using military force for regime change there?
Well, there are ways to extract people without, yes, obviously there could be casualties and all that, but there's no other way to get these thugs out of the country mm-hmm. or out of the power. So yes, it is imperative to have a force there is already around Venezuela mm-hmm. today with the ships and the U.S. navies and right. all that. But hey, it could be as clean or as dirty as that, and mm-hmm. obviously that is a fear we all, you know.
You think she agrees with at least having that option there on the table?
I think so.
Okay. Maria Alejandra Marquez, I also wanted to ask you how big a morale boost this is, not just for the democracy movement inside Venezuela, but also for the Venezuelan diaspora here, especially given what it has to deal with, it's had to deal with this year in terms of the mass deportations of Venezuelan migrants that the Trump administration mm-hmm. has been pursuing.
Well, I think it showcases the fact that the reality of Venezuela is complex, that Venezuelans that have come to this country have come mostly because they were forced to, and they are here really to work and create and be part of society. But I also would say that it has shown, and at least our work in INRAV, in which we have managed to get bipartisan support in a legislation for Venezuela, that shows that the Venezuelan case is a case for liberty and peace. It's not a case just to pinpoint a few bad apples that could have happened. And I understand this is a very complicated issue. I think it boosts us because it shows what we really are about, mm-hmm. and what the Venezuelan society has been fighting for so many years. Right. So this is a great opportunity because it changes the narrative. It shows what really we've been working for the last two decades.
Beatriz Olavarria, as I mentioned at the outset, I think Machado's Nobel Peace Prize is a big morale boost, not just for Venezuelans, but for all the democracy movements in the Americas, especially the Cuban movement, when you consider how closely aligned the Cuban and Venezuelan dictatorships are. The Cuban exile community here in Miami, for example, played a large role in nominating Maria Corina Machado mm-hmm. for the Nobel.
Yes.
How important is her award then to the rest of the hemisphere, do you think?
Well, I think it gives you hope. It gives us hope. I mean, I've had messages since when people in Europe, 3 a.m, and I haven't stopped reading them. And people have called, and everybody's so happy. And I think this does boost, more effort, more engagement, more, hope. Mm-hmm. So I think it's contagious.
Yeah,
that is contagious. Mm-hmm.
Maria Alejandra Marquez, in just the minute or so we have left here, I wanted to ask you, too, where do you think Maria Corina Machado's Nobel Prize now takes the cause of democracy in Venezuela? Will it move that cause forward, or will it prompt the dictatorship to just dig in anger more, as it so often does?
Well, I think the anger could and may come, but I think the movement is only forward. I mean, when Maduro decided to steal the elections in such a public way, although it was very disappointing, my feeling at the time was this is going to cost him. And this is a proof that this is costing him. Because
right.
what is going to tell the few Venezuelans that still follow them when you right. see a recognition like this? What is the story you're going to be behind it?
Right.
So I think it's going to definitely move the movement forward.
Right.
I have no doubt.
Beatriz, in just 30 seconds, do you agree?
Absolutely.
Why?
Because it is contagious. It's just like that. I mean, you wish, I mean, Cuba is hopeful, too. I've had 4 people here that are Cubans and a very good friend of mine, and they're like, yeah. We're next.
Okay, mm-hmm. we'll have to leave it there. Thank you. Beatriz Olavarria is a Miami coordinator for the Vente Venezuela Party, a Venezuelan opposition leader, and now Nobel Prize laureate, Maria Corina Machado. Maria Alejandra Marquez heads the Venezuelan dictatorship watchdog nonprofit INRAV. Our thanks to you both as always. Still to come, the Miami-Dade College land dispute and Donald Trump's presidential library. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. So is it land gift or land grab? Last month, the Miami-Dade College Board of Trustees voted unanimously to transfer a plot of valuable downtown property the college owns next door to the iconic Freedom Tower over to the state of Florida. The state then gave the property over for a presidential library in honor of President Donald Trump. Miami-Dade College board members called it a too-good-to-pass-up opportunity to help develop downtown Miami by hitching that land to the Trump legacy. The move has sparked an outcry, though, among Trump's critics, of course, but also from those who feel a Trump presidential library there would clash with an immigration landmark like the Freedom Tower, given President Trump's controversial immigration policies. Miami historian Marvin Dunn filed a lawsuit this week to block the land transfer, claiming the Miami-Dade College trustees did not give adequate public notice before their September 23rd vote. Do you think the trustees' land decision was right or wrong? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now from both sides of this issue will first be Miami attorney Andres Rivero of the Rivero Mestre firm, who represents Marvin Dunn in his suit. And a little later, I'll speak with Roberto Alonso, the vice president of the Miami-Dade College Board of Trustees. Mr. Rivero, thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
And I should note, we reached out to Marvin Dunn himself, but he is out of town and unavailable to join us. So to start, Mr. Rivero, could I ask you to remind our listeners what the basis of Mr. Dunn's lawsuit against this Miami-Dade College land transfer is? It rests mainly on a procedural issue. Is that correct?
The violation that we're alleging is of the Florida Sunshine Law, and specifically that no reasonable notice was given in a notice given 7 days before a meeting about the transfer of this very valuable land. And that land was not promised for purposes of a presidential library. I'd like to correct that. That's very important to be understood.
Okay. But the Miami-Dade College trustees insist that a week before the September 23rd meeting, as you point out, they did post a notice that they would be discussing land and property issues. Their claim, as I understand it, is that they were not required to specify which land issues were on the agenda. What is your response to that argument on their part?
Look, the purpose of the law is to give the public an opportunity to intervene, to comment, to make their opinions known. A notice that said very, very in a very limited fashion that they were going to discuss real estate transactions, that's all that was said, would give notice to no one unless you were in on the deal.
But are they required to get more specific than that?
Yeah, they have to give reasonable notice of what they're going to discuss. And let me just repeat, unless you were in on it, there's no way you would know that the plan was to, when you say discuss real estate transactions, to transfer 2.63 acres in an extraordinarily valuable location for free.
Okay. And as I said, the trustees' claim is that no, that kind of specificity, it was not required. That's something that will obviously be hashed out as this suit moves forward. But Mr. Rivera, what are some of the other issues involved in this land transfer that Mr. Dunn's lawsuit points to in its claim that this move by the Miami-Dade College trustees and then by the state was not legitimate? And as you pointed out, that there's nothing written there or that says that this land could be used for that purpose. What are some of the other issues besides the procedural issue that we just discussed?
Right. So besides the fact that no reasonable notice was given, it's really important that your listeners understand the grant to this Trump Foundation does not require that the land be used for a presidential library. What it says is that within 5 years, construction will start on a component of a library, museum, or center.
A complex, as it were.
No, a component, a part. I don't know what they mean. I think it's impossible to know what they mean by a component, but what I do know is that that means not all the land has to be dedicated to a library, which means it can be dedicated to private development. That's the critical thing that your listeners need to understand is they've given this for free, and it can be used for private development.
Okay. In the broader picture, though, Mr. Rivera, what do Mr. Dunn and other opponents of this downtown Miami land transfer to President Trump's use, whether it's a presidential library or any other, what do they cite as the biggest reasons that this move is wrong for Miami? The Miami-Dade College trustees insist this will be a cachet boon for the city's downtown development. Why do you disagree, or why do the opponents disagree, in your view?
Yes, and I think it's important to hear from the trustee who's going to speak. That land, and I've spoken to people who were involved in the original transaction, that land was purchased by the college, which is the biggest public college in the United States, which heavily serves this community and is principally for minority students. That was purchased either for the expansion of the college or for its future benefit as it became more valuable. It was bought for $24 million.
Right.
For the finances of the college. Today, the estimates are, as raw land, it's worth between $200 and $370 million.
Right.
So what's critical is that there be public discussion about what the right thing to do is with this public land.
We have Addie on line one, who does not agree with the development move downtown there. Addie, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your objections?
My objections are Miami is a city of immigrants. We're all from somewhere. The Freedom Tower is for the immigrants who came here, the Cuban immigrants, and also he has set himself in Palm Beach. He can go in Palm Beach.
Okay, right, where Mar-a-Lago is. Okay, so there's that the immigration argument again that we've heard. Finally then, Mr. Rivera, what is next in the process for Mr. Dunn's lawsuit? We understand that you have filed a request for an emergency hearing. Where do things go from here in the minute we have left here?
Yeah, very quickly, we actually have a request from the court asking whether we're available for hearing this afternoon. That'll depend on the schedules of especially the lawyers for the college, but we may have an emergency hearing on this as early as the next few hours. We intend to stop the transfer of title so that this could be considered and corrective action can be taken.
Okay. Andres Rivero is an attorney in Miami with the Rivero Mestre firm. Mr. Rivero, many thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN, and we have another caller on the line, Peter on line two. Peter, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your comments, just very briefly, please, about this dispute?
Thank you very much. Peter Ehrlich from Miami. I strongly support Dr. Marvin Dunn and Attorney Rivero. I think this issue needs to be investigated. There seems to be a lot of red flags, and I hope Attorney Rivero and Dr. Dunn are successful.
Okay, thank you, Peter. We're discussing the controversial transfer of downtown Miami-Dade College land for a Trump presidential library or any other component, as Mr. Rivero just pointed out there. I just spoke with Miami attorney Andres Rivero, who represents a lawsuit opposing the deal. I now want to welcome Roberto Alonso, vice president of the Miami-Dade College Board of Trustees. He joins us from Orlando. Mr. Alonso, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be on your program today.
And a reminder again to our listeners that they can weigh in. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Mr. Alonso, I just want to first note to our listeners that because the lawsuit I just discussed with Mr. Rivero is pending litigation, the Miami-Dade College Board of Trustees cannot discuss it, so you and I, therefore, will not discuss it. But we still thought it was important for our listeners to hear the trustees' side of the larger dispute. So let me just start by asking why the Miami-Dade College trustees unanimously believe that the transfer of the downtown Miami property to something like the Trump Presidential Library is the best move for the college and for the city.
Well, I think it's important to first recognize that when the board voted on this land transfer, this conveyance, we didn't know that it would later be proposed to be a presidential library. What we had received was simply a request from the state to convey the land over. And only after our vote did we get confirmation through a series of tweets that the land was being proposed for presidential library.
Right. And I did point out in the intro that this library aspect of this was not decided until the state then transferred the land over to the Presidential Library Foundation, as it's known, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay. Why then do you and the trustees feel that whatever, you know, this development might entail, that, as I said, it will be a boon for downtown Miami?
Absolutely. Well, look, the idea of having a presidential library in Miami is a tremendous opportunity for us. Presidential libraries are living classrooms of democracy, which is really what Miami-Dade is all about. They preserve the history and the lessons of our nation's highest offer, while also driving a lot of civic learning and tourism and economic growth. So if it truly becomes a reality, it would be strengthening downtown's Miami's role as a cultural and educational hub and truly elevate our city's national and international prestige.
And aside from a library, if that is the case, what about the other components that we keep hearing would be developed around it, you know, as a sort of a complex around this library idea?
It would be very difficult to discuss anything to that notion right now because we don't have any details.
Sure.
I haven't personally seen any renderings or designs or even thoughts of what it might look like.
Okay.
So those we hope will be conversations that'll come up as the process moves along.
What's your response to the argument, though, that this almost 3-acre property is just too valuable to be handed over in this way? Many feel that because it's worth about $67 million now, if not much more, according to appraisers, it should have been leveraged more for Miami-Dade College's benefit than, say, for President Trump's.
Well, let's first realize that this is not to benefit President Trump. This is to benefit our community by having a presidential library. There are over 13 other presidential libraries around this country that are built on donated land or land that's been transferred over to the ability to host a presidential library in their community. So it's important that we know that it's been the way in which presidential libraries have been developed in the past. And this is not about President Trump particularly. This is about having a library in Miami that is going to honor the highest office in the United States, which is the presidential office, to bring to our community a place where students can come and learn and talk about civic engagement and talk about freedom and leadership within our country. So I think that's the bigger picture that we have to focus in here. Not so much President Trump, but a presidential library.
Okay. What about the other prominent argument we hear, for example, from our caller earlier, Addie, that this is a more sensitive issue because the property involved sits next to the Freedom Tower and all the immigration history and emotion that that represents, and that President Trump's immigration policies create some controversy in that regard? I would point, for example, to the argument your fellow trustee Marcel Felipe made in a Miami Herald op-ed that former Democratic President Barack Obama was also notorious for deportations, and yet the more liberal folks protesting this land transfer don't seem to make an issue of that.
Well, look, I can't speak to Mr. Philippe's comments. We don't communicate when it comes to these. We're obviously under the Sunshine Law, and any questions on his interpretations should really be directed to him.
Okay.
But my focus as a board member is ensuring on transparency, sound governance, and a decision that benefits our students and our community. That said, it's important to remember that this presidential library is a nonpartisan institution. They're not about promoting politics, whether it's Republicans or Democrats.
Right.
They're about preserving history and encouraging civic learning and inspiring leadership. So each of these libraries, that you look at them throughout the country, they really reflect on the challenges and the lessons of the time in which the presidency occurred, and it invites the public to come and engage on open dialogue.
Right. We have another caller, Elizabeth from Miami. Elizabeth, welcome to the South Florida Roundup. What are your thoughts about this issue?
I'm going to say I actually completely disagree with what he just said. If you look at presidential libraries across the country, they're usually put in the president's hometown, okay, or a home state, and it's about that president and what that president did. This isn't his hometown. Miami is not. He's from New York. It should be in New York. New York doesn't want him. And I think this is like everything else in Miami politics is being shoved down our
Right.
throats.
Well,
We're not getting a chance to vote on it.
Right. Well, you could also say Mar-a-Lago would be just as much his home as New York. Mr. Alonso, what is your reaction to that idea that, well, you know, it should be New York or Palm Beach County, not Miami?
Look, as we know, this project right now is something that is just being discussed. If it does move forward, I think it would be an amazing one for our community because it's going to serve as a place of education and reflection and civic engagement. Everybody's going to have their personal opinions on this. As somebody who's leading the largest college in the nation as one of its board of trustees, I have to always do what's in the best interest of strengthening democracy and advancing what it is that our mission is, which is education, and can't fall into any particular political agenda and need to focus just on the educational components of things.
A poll of Miami residents out this week found that most do not agree with this Miami-Dade College land transfer. What do you feel Miami-Dade residents aren't taking into account that they should be considering when they look at this proposal?
Well, I think right now it's being over-politicized, and I think the focus needs to be back on the educational components of what presidential libraries truly reflect. And if we really focus in on that and the economic development that it can bring to our city, everybody will then start to understand what the true benefits are of having a presidential library in our community. So I think as time goes by and as more information comes on, our community is going to be more and more engaged. And we hope to invite them all to come and visit that cultural center of Miami that's going to be sitting there together with the Freedom Tower, together with other museums, where our students, our community, our visitors can come and truly engage in civil discourse.
Finally, Mr. Malonzo, I guess one of the big questions a lot of folks like me have, and perhaps one that the trustees had as well, is if this property is so valuable, why has nothing really been done by Miami-Dade College to develop it since it was purchased in 2004? Why is it still just a parking lot, I think is what you often hear from a lot of people who are trying to figure this out.
Absolutely. And, you know, since I've been on the trust as a trustee on the board over 6 years now, there's never really been plans there as to what can come to that property. The only thing I've heard is in the past presidency of a previous president, there was discussion on doing a high-rise condo, luxury condos on the site with, you know, some other components to it. I would never agree to putting a high-rise condominium building next to our Freedom Tower. I would much rather prefer something that is focused on education, and I think that a presidential library could do that. But at this moment, you know, we're kind of just waiting and seeing, and we look forward to what the future can bring to the downtown Miami.
Okay. Roberto Alonso is Vice President of the Miami-Dade College Board of Trustees. Mr. Alonso, many thanks. Still to come, what the eradication of street crosswalk art in Florida really means, especially for the LGBTQ community. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Paget. Monday morning, Miami Beach residents woke up to find that the multicolored LGBTQ Pride crosswalk that had adorned iconic Ocean Drive since 2018 had been removed by state workers. The state says it had to be taken out under a new law, the first of its kind in the U.S., that bans crosswalk art and messages on public streets and roads. In recent months, Governor Ron DeSantis' administration has gotten rid of similar crosswalk decorations in cities like Gainesville to Key West. DeSantis argues that any kind of crosswalk art is being removed, even one saluting law enforcement in Tampa. And he says this is about safety, not censorship. But most have been rainbow-style LGBTQ pride expressions, including one that paid tribute to the victims of the 2016 Pulse nightclub massacre in Orlando. As a result, activists say the law's real unspoken purpose is to eradicate public approval of the gay community, similar, they say, to DeSantis' so-called Don't Say Gay law for public schools. What do you think is behind Florida's new crosswalk art law? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now from Miami Beach is Joe Saunders. He's the senior political director for the nonprofit LGBTQ advocacy group Equality Florida. Joe, thank you for being with us.
Glad to be here, Tim. Thanks so much.
You have been leading Equality Florida's response to the state's removal of these rainbow crosswalks, including in Miami Beach, where you reside with your husband. What have the last few months involved in terms of dealing with the state and trying to preserve these crosswalks? And why has it been so important to the LGBTQ community to preserve them in the first place?
Well, thank you for inviting me. This is a really important discussion to be having with the state. I want to answer that question by offering a really important point, which is, despite what the governor says on microphones as he hosts his press conferences, there is no new law from the legislature, no rule that's been promulgated through public processes as required by law that requires these street art, these street murals to be removed. What's actually happened is that the governor, as part of his years-long campaign against the LGBT community, against our history, against books that include LGBT characters, you know, his regular attacks against the transgender community, you know, this is just one more way that he is punching down at the LGBT community. And so he's reinterpreted the guidebooks that require cities, that cities are required to use when installing public safety and street murals and different things related to traffic, to now ban these murals. We think it's illegal. We've encouraged cities to sue, like the city of Fort Lauderdale is doing.
Right.
But we don't think there is not a new law that requires this, and it is just one more attack from a governor that will be the most anti-LGBTQ governor in our lifetimes.
I should mention that Texas has also been calling for the removal of such crosswalks. Starting this week, Governor Greg Abbott there has also taken the same stance. But Joe, the Miami Beach Pride crosswalk was perhaps the marquee showcase for this kind of public street art in Florida. How much of a gut punch was it to the LGBTQ community to see it removed this week?
I think it was very challenging. You know, Ocean Drive is one of the most famous streets in the country, possibly the world. But it's really important to know that these murals, they were not just art and paint on street or bricks in the case of Ocean Drive. Rainbow, these street murals are often installed, like they were in Orlando at Pulse, like they were in Delray Beach in response to the tragedy at the at Pulse nightclub. They've always been anchored in a memorialization of the discrimination that LGBTQ people have experienced, not just from the public, but from government, and a visible reminder of that discrimination and a promise by government to not do it again. Mm-hmm. So when we see them pulled up, when we see FDOT, the Florida Department of Transportation, send in bulldozers to Ocean Drive, it is quite a gut punch. But I do just want to say, Tim, the majority of cities that have been forced by the state to remove the art on the streets have already committed to build back Boulder with even greater visibility and recognition of the LGBT community. Mm-hmm. I think it's a sign that governments at the local level understand we are here, we're not going away, and the LGBT community deserves to these moments of recognition.
But as I mentioned at the outset, Governor DeSantis and the state of Florida insist this is not about targeting the gay community, that it's all about public street safety. What is your response to that claim, especially given that Florida is the first to pursue this kind of crosswalk removal, and given that we don't see this kind of prohibition, say, at the federal level?
Yeah, I have three quick and important responses to that. First, these murals that were installed have all been approved by the Department of Transportation under their own standards, the standards that the governor reinterpreted to wage his war on rainbows.
Okay, so just to be sure, to clear, in 2018, when the Miami Beach crosswalk was installed, that received state approval.
In order for these installations, the majority of them, to be installed, you have to do it in coordination with the Florida Department of Transportation. So, okay. For example, in Orlando, at the crosswalk at Pulse, it was expressly submitted and approved by the Department of Transportation. The second point I want to make quickly is that all of the cities that have installed these street murals have data around public safety. And what we've seen over and over again is that street art actually increases public safety. It makes drivers more aware. It tends to make them slow down. And third, actually over 400 pieces of street art installation have been removed under this directive from the governor that we all know is really about attacking pride flags. And it has made the state less safe. In Seminole County, for example, millions of dollars was spent to paint crosswalks and bike lanes green. They got a directive from the state under this new interpretation of standing guidance that they needed to remove it because it was out of compliance. We are less safe in Florida because the governor has decided to wage a war on rainbow street art.
So to your mind, this is just an addendum, let's say, to the governor's so-called Don't Say Gay agenda to keep LGBTQ people and issues out of the public eye, if not out of public approval?
Tim, what I really think happens with this governor is that whenever he is feeling squeezed or pressurized, when he's in the middle of a scandal, like the Hope Florida scandal or any other number of things that have come up for him, he tries to change the subject. And the LGBT community is always one of his first targets when that strategy emerges. So yes, this is one more attack, one more way of punching down at a community that he sees as unable to defend itself. But we are fighting back. And what I'm very proud of is that in places like Miami Beach, in the same day that the Department of Transportation was, you know, bulldozing up bricks on Ocean Drive, yeah, City Commissioner Alex Fernandez was raising a canopy of pride flags in the air directly over where those bricks were laid. We're not going to be silenced. We're not going to be made invisible. And our local officials are standing with us.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with Joe Saunders, Senior Political Director for the LGBTQ advocacy group Equality Florida, about the removal of crosswalk art across Florida. Most recently, the celebrated design on Miami Beach's Ocean Drive under a new state law. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joe, staying on that question of whether this is about public safety or gay censorship, this week we also saw a story in the New York Times about the financial struggles that the Stonewall National Museum in Fort Lauderdale has been experiencing, a museum dedicated to the national LGBTQ rights movement that was founded in 1973. The story cited federal cuts, but also anti-LGBTQ pressure in Florida. Do you expect to see more of this sort of thing beyond just the crosswalks enforcement now?
Well, there's no question that at the federal government, we've seen a turn, and at the state level, we've seen a perpetuation of this anti-LGBTQ sentiment from Governor DeSantis. So I'm not surprised to hear that public sources of funding from both federal and state, you know, avenues may be more restricted now than they used to be. I think it's important for people to remember two things. One, that the federal government and Governor DeSantis have been pushing this idea of a tax on diversity, equity, and inclusion in the broadest way possible, and then creating an environment where folks are left to interpret what that means to themselves. Mm-hmm. And so there has been a real danger in that vagueness to allow the fear of who you can include, who you can allow access to a grant for funding, for example, to lead to a level of censorship that's really dangerous, and people across the state need to push back. That museum is a really important part of the fabric of the cultural institutions in the state of Florida, and it offers real contributions. We need to support that museum.
How has this impacted the state's LGBTQ community and its morale specifically, especially when we see that even, as I mentioned, the crosswalk commemorating the victims of the Pulse nightclub massacre in Orlando was removed in this state campaign?
You know, I've been a part of the work to meet the challenge of these crosswalk fights, of the street mural fights, for the last 3 months. I've been in almost every city where this has happened. And an important thing for your listeners to understand is that these murals have been installed in almost every situation within a community in a city that has a long legacy and history of LGBTQ experience, right? We call them our gayborhoods sometimes. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen in every single one of these fights is not a shrinking away, not our community, you know, stepping back in fear, but instead actually pushing forward to engaging with our local elected officials who are part of installing these murals and inspiring a commitment to building back even bolder visibility, right? This is an example of why those murals came into existence to begin with. And in nearly every city where this has come up, already ideas for replacing them with canopies in the air, in Key West, there's an arch that will be installed exactly over Wall Street with a rainbow where there's rainbow used to be on the street. Like, we are seeing people push forward, not fall
back.
Yeah,
well, that's my last question then, Joe, in just a couple of minutes we have left here. What are the potential responses the LGBTQ community can pursue at this point? If not crosswalks, what other forms of public expression are still available to you to convey gay pride, especially in cities like Miami Beach, where, as you point out, the LGBTQ community plays such a large social and economic role?
Absolutely. Well, I will say first that the legal fight around this is not over. I want to acknowledge Commissioner Steve Glassman, a Fort Lauderdale commissioner who has led his commission towards bringing legal challenges to this reinterpretation of current guidance around street safety. We should fight for the ability to establish street murals and street art and street safety in all kinds of forms. But cities like Key West have responded by envisioning arches that will go over Duval Street. In Gainesville, there are bold ideas about establishing a mural right in the center of the downtown area where the crosswalk was, which would be a mural protected under historic preservation protections. There are ideas of murals that are going up on buildings instead of on the streets here in Miami Beach. The same day that the Department of Transportation bulldozers were scooping up bricks, there were a canopy of pride flags that were flown in the air over 12th Street, right, and a proposal from Commissioner Alex Fernandez to rename 12th Street Pride Street. So local governments are responding to this challenge by doubling down and recommitting to honoring the legacy of LGBTQ contributions in these cities and memorializing a commitment to never discriminating again.
Okay. Joe Saunders is Senior Political Director for Equality Florida. Joe, many thanks. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
Finally on the roundup, this weekend we say goodbye to what once was one of Miami's premier tourist attractions, the Miami Seaquarium. A new chapter for the attraction is coming as developer David Martin has agreed to purchase the lease for $22.5 million and redevelop the space. This comes after a year-long eviction process by Miami-Dade County against this aquarium's current owner, Mexico-based Dolphin Company. This was over animal welfare concerns. Martin's plan, which is conditioned on approval by the county commission, is to retain this aquarium name and open a space focused on marine life education and conservation with no marine mammals. He says there will also be a marina, restaurants, and a bay walk along Biscayne Bay.
Miami Seaquarium's meant so much for this community for so many years, for decades. And I think one of the main purposes was to inspire the community. We're going to be preserving the Golden Dome, but it's something that I think is going to be an amazing family-friendly destination.
The attraction's last day for guests to visit the park will be Sunday. As for the marine mammals, they will be relocated with oversight from the county to ensure their well-being. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.